Hey Mud Podcast presents.
This is Global Stuff. My name is Jimmy Derschlag. We're recording this a little early on May 21st, a couple days before, and you're listening on Friday, May 25th. If you haven't heard this show before, it comes out of actually my many years of the Mainstream Media Project and putting people on the radio, but also now it's almost getting to be a couple decades of talking to people who are doing important work, a lot of it with global impact, but of course all of it that affects us in some ways in our daily lives. And I'm really pleased today to have Ian Lustig, who is Emeritus Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania. He has been working on issues of Israel, Palestine, the Middle East. He teaches Middle East politics, comparative politics, and has just been involved for many years, an author of many books, the most recent, Paradigm Lost, From Two-State Solution to One-State Reality, about the situation in Palestine, Israel, many other books as well. And I think in hearing some of the presentations that he did, it's like five decades. Is that what you were saying, Ian?
That's right. I actually published my first article on this topic in 1970. It was an article in the labor Zionist journal Jewish Frontier, and it was based on a paper that I wrote as an undergraduate while in Israel, studying what do West Bank Palestinians really want in 69. And my analysis at that time was, although the PLO wouldn't say it, and many of Palestinians were a little afraid to talk publicly, they really wanted a separate state in the West Bank and Gaza, and that this was the future for them. It's something that the PLO would, I said, in a few years endorse. That was in 1970, so that was 55 years ago.
And we're still going through it today.
I'm still struggling. It's tragic, it's horrible, and it's absolutely fascinating. So that's why I've been involved in it so long.
Part of the reason, the impetus behind bringing you on the show was the email I got from you with these several video shorts, and we'll be talking about some of the presentations there. I guess this is a project of the Academics for Peace. You can see their website, academicsforpeace.org. Short videos that try to encapsulate a subject in an understandable way and communicate that, and yours certainly do that. But I wanted to start out, you already went into that, your background some, but if you have anything to add to the what you've done over your career in a, you know, I know there's a lot to cover, but.
Well, I think the audience would be interested to know that that when I started out, I mean, I grew up in a very small town in northern New York, very, very few Jews, although a small kind of little shtetl kind of community. In my high school class of over 400, there were four Jewish kids. So I grew up with a lot of ambient anti-Semitism, but also a very warm feeling for a community that wasn't really well educated, but was very traditional in its outlook on what life was like for Jews in a Gentile world. And I also grew up with very strong feelings about the Holocaust, where I lost so many members of my family, and Israel. I went there in 1979 for the first time for 6 months. I went to Brandeis University because I wanted to find out what Jews were really like. I had never had a Jewish teacher in my life. I couldn't imagine what it would be like. So I really came out of a background which most American Jews, if they lived in metropolitan areas with a lot of Jews around, would find unfamiliar, and yet it was in some ways a very traditional background. I became exposed to the Palestinian problem in 1969 in a refugee camp. I saw pretty quickly, talking to some pretty sophisticated Israelis at that time, along with Palestinians, that I had been completely unaware of the extent to which the encounter between Jews and Palestinian Arabs in the land of Israel or in Palestine was a tragedy. It wasn't a story of triumph over evil. It was a tragedy that in which both peoples were faced with immense problems and immense amounts of suffering because of the other. And so that led me, when I went back to Brandeis, to feel like I wanted to understand this. This was what I wanted to do with a great deal of my academic life. And my concern was that there would be so many people doing this that I'd be outcompeted. There would be too many people because it was so obviously fascinating, especially for Jews. What I didn't realize was that for most Jews, it was so emotionally difficult to study it objectively that very, very few of my generation, of my cohort, even those who were interested in it, were willing to actually professionally study it. And so that left me in what turned out to be a very unusual position of being Jewish and of having strong feelings about both Palestinians and Israelis, and spending a lot of my professional life professionally focused on the issue. I can tell you one funny story about that. A long time ago, in the late 70s, BRERA had a meeting in Washington. That was one of the early organizations that was challenging Israeli policies in the West Bank and Gaza. I started one a little earlier than that called Yesh BRERA, the same idea. Stop settlements, make peace with the Palestinians. Well, in a meeting in Washington with several hundred people, there was a secret meeting convened at night that was closed to the press about whether there should be public criticism of Israel by Jews. And Shlomo Avineri was the featured speaker. He was the director general of the foreign ministry, a very well-known professor at the Hebrew University, very articulate, very prominent in Labor Party circles. And he spoke and said that private criticism of Israel was fine, but that no Jew was allowed to publicly criticize Israel. That was a shanda. And I stood in line for several hours in order to ask a question. And around midnight, I was finally able to ask him the following question. I said that my name was Ian Lustig. We had actually met in Berkeley. I said I was an assistant professor at Dartmouth College, and I specialized in Arab-Israeli politics. I said, if you are saying that Jews cannot speak publicly about this problem, how can I or how can any Jew be a professional academic when we aren't allowed to say what we think publicly? Are you saying? So his response was, I will say now that Ian Lustig has the right to speak publicly and critically about Israel. So he made an exception for me.
So did he publish that so the world knows?
No, this was a closed-to-the-press midnight meeting of the BRERA, in which they were being instructed by the Israeli Foreign Ministry not to publicly criticize Israel, except I was allowed to, because otherwise you would ban Jews from being professionally engaged in the study of Israel.
Well, it's too bad you couldn't have used that authorization at the times when you've been attacked for the things that you've written.
I'm glad to share the story today.
So, talking about some of these short videos that have been posted, the first two that you had in your list were both about the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, which was voted down. It wasn't, or voting delayed, I guess. And, you know, maybe you could, I don't know what the status of that is now, but it seemed like just a pretty horrendous act to put forward. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, the tax was actually passed by the House of Representatives, and it's a tax which essentially is enabling and trying to encourage the government to use its resources aggressively to prosecute anyone suspected of anti-Semitism, to try to reduce and protect the rights of Jews. But the definition of anti-Semitism, of what constitutes that, is the problem, because it refers to the IHRA, International Holocaust Remembrance Association formulation, as something that can be invoked as a definition. And that is a hoax. That formula is well known. It's been used by the Trump administration before. It's used by the ADL. It's used by many what I call vigilante groups to try very explicitly to suppress criticism of Israel. It was this IHRA definition, as it calls itself, is not really a definition. What it is a list of things that might be said that could be considered anti-Semitism. There is no definition offered that anti-Semitism is this, not that. It just says, here are some things that could be considered anti-Semitic. And of the things, half a dozen or more have to do with things you can't say about Israel. For example, you're not allowed to say, it's considered anti-Semitic if you say whether that Israel is racist. What I have pointed out in my video is that means you can ask questions about other countries like Russia or the United States or South Africa or China. Are they racist? You're not allowed to ask that question about Israel. Is Israel racist? Because when you ask a question, you're essentially making a statement and then evaluating its truth value. So if you can't say it, you can't ask the question. What I point out is that another part of this bizarre hoax is that you're not allowed to use a double standard when it comes to Israel. But by saying that you can ask about any other country whether it's racist, but you can't ask whether Israel is racist, that is using a double standard. So it's completely absurd. The House of Representatives had passed it. The Senate was about to pass it. But then a bizarre thing happened. Some really genuine anti-Semites were upset because inside the bill it says that conventional markers of anti-Semitism, such as accusations that the Jews killed Christ, that they're Christ killers, that is also anti-Semitic. Well, these members of Congress, these Republicans, were evangelicals and others, were concerned that they would no longer be able to say that the Jews killed Christ because they were passing a law that said it was anti-Semitic. So they got very upset all of a sudden, and the organizers of the bill in the committee decided to pull it instead of pushing it forward until they could come to some kind of a compromise agreement on this bizarre aspect. So it's in abeyance now. It will probably come back in another form, but the previous Congress tried, it was an attempt to promulgate it as law that failed. But what's important is that the administration, either without this legislation, has used this bizarre formulation, the IHRA definition, in order to go after universities, to use the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Education to persecute and prosecute people whose views they consider unwelcome, who are critical of Israel, as if they are anti-Semites.
I want to remind the listeners, this is Global Stuff. My name is Jimmy Derschlag. This is a pre-recorded version, recorded a couple of days before you're hearing it. We're talking to Ian Lustig, who's Emeritus Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania and an author of many pieces, and has been talking a lot about the Middle East and Israel and Palestine for, as we said, decades. Moving into the issue of the administration's actions on anti-Semitism, Some of the statements I've seen, and we'll talk about the universities and the Joint Task Force statement from the administration, but some of the statements I've seen is like they're using this as a tool to, it's not just promoting support for Israel, but actually allowing them to attack on a broader scale the whole concept of academic freedom and academic discourse, which in according to what you see from the administration is they don't want people really thinking in broad ways about what they're doing and having critical discussions of these issues. So even though they're using the platform of going after 60, I think, 60 universities, higher education institutions about claiming anti-Semitism there and even wanting to have their curriculum and police their curricula, it seems like it's almost like a cover for a different agenda.
Absolutely. First, I want to, before what I respond directly to the question of ulterior motives and the disingenuousness of this entire witch hunt, I want to point out that I do believe that anti-Semitism, which by which I mean hatred of or persecution or prejudice against Jews because they're Jews, is a real problem. It's real. It's not only real, it's increasing.
Yeah, it's been growing.
One of the main reasons it's increasing as a problem is because a state that calls itself Jewish is committing so many acts that are disgusting to most people that it disinhibits people who are anti-Semites from expressing that. After all, this is the Jewish state, the so-called Jewish state that's doing it. And I think it encourages some people to slide over from anti-Israelism to anti-Semitism because it's so easy to conflate the two once the state that's doing it does it in the name of the Jewish people. Remember, when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, the American government interned hundreds of thousands of Japanese citizens in the United States as if just because the without any evidence that any of them had connections to the Japanese government, but because the Japanese government was acting on behalf of the Japanese people in its own propaganda, all of these people were treated as the enemy. Well, that's the context in which I believe there really is an increasing problem of anti-Semitism, but it is not only made worse, it is counterproductive to imagine that a campaign designed to win battles in a much broader cultural and political war is going to help combat anti-Semitism. It's going to increase it. Because I believe what you said is correct. This attack on the universities is really an attack on intellectual life itself. It's an attack on people viewed as elites, people who are critics of the dominant, more or less Philistine attitude toward culture and learning. And this is the way the Trump MAGA forces in the United States, allied with evangelicals and the Israel lobby, see an opportunity to work together for different objectives. In my own university, it's quite apparent, it's been quite apparent just how operative ulterior motives are, whether it is that some big donors are angry because they're, from their point of view, their children or nephews aren't getting into Penn and all these non-whites are getting into Penn, and so something should be changed, or because by being active on the front lines or appearing to be struggling against anti-Semitism, you can make for yourself a name that will be useful in Israeli politics when you go back to Israel, which is also something that happens, or whether it's because you can exert power in the institution against people whose views you've never liked and wanted to suppress for a long time. You don't want Palestinian voices heard. You don't want voices critical of Israel teaching courses. You don't want students to encounter that issue as something that they study like other issues. It's to be avoided or treated only in the context of a kind of snowflakey discussion. It's odd, and I guess this is going on a bit beyond your question, but we have at Penn a professor in the law school, Amy Wax, who got into a lot of trouble because she said some very negative, explicitly prejudiced things about minority students in the law school where she teaches, and why they shouldn't be expected or wouldn't be expected that they would be successful. And she was attacked for this by Black Lives Matter movement. She was attacked for saying these cruel and discriminatory things. But people on the right, people associated with the Israel lobby, people from FIRE, defended her as she's just speaking her mind. And these people are acting like snowflakes. They can't handle the truth. So now what's happening is that the only people, according to those people who are making those accusations, who are allowed to be snowflakes are Jewish students.
Right.
There's no worry about whether Palestinians or Muslims their feelings are being hurt by the verbiage that comes out of the mouths of many university representatives about Israel, about October 7th. I mean, the verbiage, there was a terrible, brutal massacre that occurred there, but you don't hear from these people the same kind of empathy for Palestinian or Arab or Muslim suffering. And this is very striking to me, that Jewish students who in the past were accusing others, or not so much the students, but the organizations who in the past were accusing non-Jewish groups, especially Blacks, Hispanics, women, gays, of being too sensitive, of claiming rights to be able to limit the speech of others because of their feelings being hurt, are now insisting that's precisely what Jewish students have the right to do to everyone else. If they can say that, oh, my feelings are hurt, I feel bad about what's being said about Jews or about Israel, therefore you can't say it. It's just ironic that this switch has occurred.
And it seems like such a double standard, as you said in several instances, but also goes over into the issue of the teaching of history, of the history of this country and the oppression of Blacks and other minority groups, that if it hurts someone's feelings to hear about slavery, it's a bad thing. You should
exactly.
Be
it's fascinating
it.
That states, Florida, others are outlawing teaching methods, textbooks, if they might make a white student or might make a male student feel guilty or feel bad.
Yeah.
That is just amazing that they've adopted the entire snowflake theory that I opposed when it was put forward by others, and I oppose it still. I think that freedom of speech on the campus is crucial to academic freedom. As long as the speech is helping others make better arguments. That means it doesn't mean whether what's said is true or false. That it's not the truth of something that gives you the right to say it. It's that what you say can help somebody else make a better argument. So if it's violent, if it's insulting, if it's ad hominem, those things cannot help other people make good arguments. But the idea that it could hurt someone's feelings, that's not a valid objection to speech on a university campus.
I think you could make the argument that in many cases making people uncomfortable is part of an intellectual process and a learning process as well.
It's hard to think of a single intellectual hero in the Western tradition, from Socrates to Galileo to Einstein to Freud, about whom that is not true. That what made them great was, of course, they made people feel uncomfortable about their prior beliefs.
Uh, talking about the universities and what's happening there, I did mention that your university, University of Pennsylvania, is on the list, as they say, and saying it has this long history of discrimination. They're talking about canceling $175 million. At least that's the figure I saw. But the Harvard is the one that's in the news so much, both Harvard and Columbia. Harvard, because they're pushing back against the administration's attempts. Columbia, because they're kind of rolling over a little bit because they are in this ridiculous lawsuit. The statement from this joint task force, several members of the administration, joint task force to combat anti-Semitism, their statement, which wasn't released that long ago, is pretty outrageous. What they're saying, the first sentence is, Harvard University has repeatedly failed to confront the pervasive race discrimination and anti-Semitic harassment plaguing its campus. And they're saying it's a part of their long-standing policy of discrimination. This is a very strong statement that the task force put out.
It's a big lie. And what is shocking is the extent to which in universities, how many people know it's a big lie, and how many people still won't say so publicly. It's McCarthyism for those of us old enough to remember what McCarthyism was like, except that you don't have an Eisenhower ready to finally, after a couple of years of hysteria, step in and say who the real hysterics are. We don't have that. So this is worse. Then this is a kind of McIsraelism, I call it, which justifies these witch hunts and makes people feel that facts and reality have nothing to do. They're so far from what is being accused, it's hard to know even how to respond. When you have the Secretary of Homeland Security saying that the meaning of habeas corpus is the opposite of what it means, instead of it being the right of citizens to a trial, to due process, it's the right of the president to detain someone. This is the reign of ignorance and the reign of misinformation is on the campuses with respect to this issue is just astonishing. So I've been able to understand. I've gotten very good information about what happens in these task forces that are set up in universities to try to respond. Okay, we have a task force on Islamophobia and anti-Semitism. What's been going on in our institution? What should we do? And I can tell you that these are not really task forces. A task force, by definition, is a group of experts that is trying to solve a problem by pooling their expertise. A task force is not a legislature. A legislature is where people with very different objectives come together and fight it out about what will they do, even though they disagree about what they want to do. These task forces have been arenas, legislative arenas, not attempts to actually solve a problem. And so whenever they occur, what happens is you get an outcome that shows the balance of power in the university between those who are trying to protect its grants by going along as much as possible with the absurd claims and absurd demands of the government, and those who can't stomach that and operate on the basis of what they know to be the case, whether there are instances of anti-Semitism, Islamophobia or not, but are trying to actually look at the problem. So when you see a report by a task force, so-called task force, what you're not really seeing is not something about the problem. You're seeing something about the balance of power within that group that produced that text. And as a side note, though, I will say that as far as I understand it, the $175 million figure you used about grants at Penn aren't really tied to anti-Semitism accusations. They had to do with a transgender athlete at Penn. So those two things can get mixed up, but that happens to be, there's other accusations about anti-Semitism, but that helped the ridiculous ejection of one Penn president because of how klutzy she was in answering a question at Congress. But I want to make sure that the audience understands that there's other issues the government is coming after universities about besides anti-Semitism. As we said before, this is a larger cultural war. And that's important because if you think you're struggling to protect one group and you're not struggling to protect another group, well, that other group, they're coming for, you know, for Hispanics, or they're coming for transgender, right. They will come for you next.
They've got a lot of excuses. I mean, they use anti-Semitism, but in many ways they're just trying to cut this funding with whatever excuse they can give if they're afraid of the academic freedom might actually discuss and give a real perspective on the policies that they're putting forth and the what's happening around the nation with that.
KMUD is a community radio station in the Redwood region of Northern California. Donate to support people-powered radio at kmud.org.
Again, I want to remind the listeners, this is Global Stuff. It's a pre-recorded version. We're recording a couple days before you hear it. My guest, Ian Lustig, Emeritus Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania. He has several short videos up at academicsforpeace.org. And if you Google or whatever search you choose to use, Ian Lustig, L-U-S-T-I-C-K, you can get to his page at the University of Pennsylvania, which has links to a lot of different interviews and articles, and he's certainly very prolific. His most recent book is Paradigm Loss from Two State Solution to One State Reality, which we may get the chance to talk about that concept a little bit. I did want to bring up, you know, it was a fascinating article to me that you wrote not long ago, Sitting on the Third Rail, Studying Israeli and Palestinians Then and Now. And it's a question that I'm sure comes up pretty regularly when people are talking with you, when you're being interviewed, that you, as a professor, a Jewish professor, a Zionist, are when you criticize Israel, when you try and broaden the discussion, you come up against a lot of criticism. And that article kind of goes over when you say sitting on the third rail. That's a perfect description of what the current, in many areas, what the current state is if you do choose to criticize Israel.
Well, yes. I mean, I wrote that piece because I was approached by group of young scholars who are starting out in this context, the last few years since the war in Gaza erupted, since the attack on October 7th, and they found it a daunting environment to go forward and look forward to spending their career in the midst of hot fire coming from every direction, threats and so on. And when I say threats, I mean academics who study this are used to getting threats to themselves repeatedly, and some of them have to be taken seriously. So it's not just threats to your career, but threats to your life, your family, your reputation, doxing threats, and so on. So I was asked, look, you've been doing this for 50 years. What's it been like? Is it always been like this? Well, to an extent, there has been. I mean, I think this right in the last few years has been worse than I've ever seen it. But the article you referred to relates some of the adventures I've had over the years, understanding what obstacles, what non-substantive criteria were brought to bear by others to judge me and judge my work. I didn't write that article to come across as some kind of victim or hero. I've had a wonderful career. I've been supported by terrific institutions, universities, Dartmouth, University of Brandeis University, University of California, Berkeley. I've had contracts with government agencies for years. I worked in the State Department. Still, as you know from that article, it is not this, the opportunities available to someone who's ready to toe the line of that AIPAC or other established Israel lobby organizations produce, those opportunities are immense compared to those that have been available to somebody like me. It's on the other hand, it's exciting to play the role, to be an intellectual force that's standing up for what you know is correct, is true, and it's fascinating to see from that standpoint what happens in a democracy, how much of what happens is driven by things that have nothing to do with what is true, how that's manipulated, how it's exploited. That's something that I've been able to study and learn from because of my personal experience, because I have so much knowledge about this particular set of affairs when it's of great interest to people, but they know so little about it, really. And so that teaches me a good deal about the way the world is, about the role of an intellectual, but the role of science and truth in relationship to democracy. These are not the relationships we learned about in civics classes in the 1950s and 60s. The relationships are much more complex and much more thoroughly political.
And of course, you had direct experience, and as you say, people going to bat for you. That's one of the real strong points in that article, is that there have been, like, maybe often a group that will approve, for example, an article or a book for publication from your very first book that you had to fight, or based on your dissertation many years ago that you had to fight for its publication, that people approved and fought for it, and then maybe one person who had the final vote, objected, and then you had other people going to bat for you.
I don't. There are many stories that I didn't tell in that. I'll tell you one of them now. Much more recent story. So I wrote an article which became a chapter in the book Paradigm Lost on the way the Holocaust is remembered in Israel, because it's not the Holocaust that has the effects on Israeli culture. It's the way it's remembered, and there have been several different constructions of the Holocaust, several different collective memories that competed with one another. And I'm not going to go through the whole argument, but part of the argument is that one particular version of the Holocaust, that I use the term Holocaustia, is the main thing it means to be Jewish, is that you survive the Holocaust, and it's something that's about to happen again.
Yeah.
That belief took hold with Menachem Begin, the right-wing political leader who became prime minister in Israel in 1977, and it has had a tremendous effect on Israeli politics and on Jewish Americans also. So I wrote this article about four constructions of the Holocaust in Israeli political culture. It's a very academic piece of work. It actually was a double article. It took up enough pages for two articles. And I submitted it to a journal on contemporary Jewish affairs. And the editor liked it, sent it out for review. It came back with all these positive reviews, so she agreed to publish it. But then the other editors of the journal, who had written about the Holocaust and were absolutely furious at this idea, objected and said, no, this should not be published. But they'd already accepted it. So they decided that only it could be published if it were at the same time published with their attack on the article. So the editor, who by this time was tearing her hair out, decided, well, okay, we're going to invite three Jewish scholars to write their comments on this article, in addition to a 10-page attack by these group of editors that didn't want the article published. So you can see it on my website. It's all there. The comments on my article are mostly praising by the scholars. This absolutely furious, vehement, vituperative attack on me, 10 pages by these editors, and then my response. Now, from my point of view, this is normal. There's not a single book I've published on Israel which hasn't gone through some kind of jihad against it before it got able to be seen in the light of day. So this is kind of typical, but I have to admit, I have a sense of humor about it, and I have a pretty thick skin. So when someone attacks me, I use it as an opportunity to advance the discussion, because usually they don't attack the substance. They're only attacking me. And if I push back on the substance, they actually don't want to talk about that publicly because their case is pretty weak. And that was the case in this exchange as well, which your audience is welcome to read on my website.
And I do want to move on. There's so much more we could say on this topic. I just heard a podcast yesterday about Project Esther from Project 2025, but we won't get into that right now, because I do think in the time we have left, it's important to talk about the issue that is spurring a lot of this discussion and has been the reason why the Trump administration has pushed back against certain individuals, arresting them for protests, which is, of course, the Gaza-Israel, not really a conflict. It's really a devastation of Gaza that's been happening and is still going on, even getting worse, even Netanyahu saying more and more that he wants to take over the whole country, and that's the whole region, and that's since, of course, Trump's wanting to convert it into the casino of the region, the luxury hotel of the region. But and it goes along with your two of your videos, the one Trump's plan for Gaza, but also what we've talked about some, that asking questions about Israel is not anti-Semitism or Jew hatred, which is what that keeps falling into. But, you know, the devastation is incredible there. Over 50,000 people killed that we know about. And the people living in such dire circumstances, it's just beyond me how people can't have any, regardless of their attitude towards Palestinians or Hamas or anything else, any kind of sympathy towards what's going on and what's happening to those people.
Yes, it's hard to wake up every day to the same horror. And I have to say that I personally think that the what's been happening has changed the situation more than anything that has happened since 1948. That, in essence, Israel has prevented itself from having a chance to survive as anything it would call a Jewish state. That is, I think it has made the regime, not the state, but the regime, that is the legal order that operates on behalf of a Zionist principle to discriminate in favor of Jews against Palestinians, has made that regime insupportable by the overwhelming majority of humanity. Then the chickens will come home to roost over the next 30 years, in which Israel will, as the former deputy chief of staff of the Israeli army just said a few days ago, that Israel is becoming a pariah state. He said something even stronger than I would say. This is he's the head of the Democratic Party in Israel, which is the liberal party, Yair Golan. He said, the IDF is killing babies as a hobby, by which he meant that the government that orders them to punish unendingly the population of Gaza is not doing what they're doing for any reason that helps Israeli security. It is out of completely unjustifiable motives of vengeance and political interest. Now, that's an Israeli former deputy chief of staff saying that. Now, I think in order to gain a little perspective on how something like Project Esther, which is an extreme witch hunt idea to go after anyone who expresses sympathy with Palestinians, can be called a part of the Hamas support network and therefore be subject to anything from imprisonment to deportation.
Considered a terrorist, right?
Terrorism or anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
But I want to point out something about Israeli Hasbara. That's the propaganda or information explanation. When I was a student at Brandeis and Berkeley, I actually debated on behalf of the Israel consulate in San Francisco. I would debate Marxists who are anti-war and anti-Zionist, because I was a liberal Zionist, and I was very effective as a debater. And one of the reasons I was effective is that they gave us a manual for debating that was produced by an Israeli student organization in the United States, Israeli professor in Israel, Benny Neuberger. And it had, here are the issues that will come up in debates. Here are the here's information about those issues. Here are the arguments you can make. Here are the good points they will make. Here are the bad points they will make. And this is how you cope with them, including, for example, settlements, in which we used to say, well, there are good there are some problems with settlements, but on the whole, it's not the main problem, et cetera, et cetera. It was a substantive guidance for how you deal with criticism of Israel. And I even got a letter from the consul general in San Francisco thanking me for my work on behalf of the consul. Then Israeli policies became so unattractive to American liberals that by the 1990s, Israel's Hasbara had shifted from trying to make arguments and to support Israeli policies, and instead accusing, trying to say, those are bad arguments that are being used, they're double standards, you're trying to delegitimize Israel, you're trying to demonize Israel. Those just attacking the arguments as illegitimate. That actually has been replaced by something even worse. Now the objective is, we don't even want any discussion of this issue. We know we can't win substantive right. discussions, so we are going to not allow anyone to speak by saying that they are terrorists and anti-Semites if they try to speak. Therefore, should Middle East centers should close. Jewish studies programs should lose their funding because they are too critical of what Israel does. It's amazing to see the groups on campus, the Jewish groups whose rabbis tell them don't take courses in Jewish studies because there's too much thinking involved. you're critically assessing things. We don't want that. So right now we're up against, in the universities and in the country in general, it's not a problem of freedom of debate. It's a problem of having any discussion at all that's substantive. That's what they're out to prevent. And one reason is because of what you say. The rights and wrongs of what's going on are so gross. They're so extreme. The contrast between what anyone who knows about the situation would be willing to accept and what they believe is happening there is so great that if you actually allowed people to learn about it, you couldn't defend Israeli policies. That's one reason why Israelis know so little about what's happening in Gaza. I watch Israeli television all the time. You can't know what's happening in Gaza. They don't report it.
Right.
It's only reported what's going on in Israel. You have to look at the foreign press, the Arab press, to know anything like what's going on there.
I want to remind the listener, we're kind of winding down on this great conversation and interview with Ian Lustig, Emeritus Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania. Been talking a lot about anti-Semitism, the vilification of people who have expressed any concern about what's going on between Israel and Gaza or questioning the policies of Israel. His most recent book, Paradigm Lost, From Two State Solution to One State Reality, and what you were just talking about, and the, as you say, no real argument against or even to support the concern for the people who are, they're talking about, oh, we finally let aid trucks in, six trucks that are actually just sitting there, they're still not delivering it, when they used to get 600 a day. I mean, this is a country that depends completely, because of how devastated it is, on outside support, and they're not getting it. And the attacks that you see.
You mentioned one of my videos And by the way, if your audience, if they're interested in those videos or my the website of my book, ParadigmLostBook.com, has many, many articles from, not by me, by many people, about the situation, interviews and videos from me, a podcast and so on, and a discussion of issues that the book raises. So the audience is welcome to go there. But one of the things, one of the videos is about Trump's plan. And he's practically abandoned it already. I mean, he's like a pinwheel with things that are going on in him because he spoke to somebody yesterday or because he had some kind of indigestion, and it flies out as some kind of wild proposal. And then the next day, something else comes out. I don't take any of them particularly seriously. But when he talked about what you referred to as turning Gaza into an American-ruled, you know, Riviera, where the Palestinians would live somewhere else, what that did reminded me of the effect of the Peel Commission. The Peel Commission was one of the British investigating commissions in the mid-30s. What should we do with this problem in Palestine? And they came up with a solution. We have to divide it into a small Jewish state and a little bit larger Arab state, and that's the solution, because it's an irrepressible conflict. Now, it didn't get implemented. The Arabs didn't accept it. The Jews really didn't like it, but they were willing to negotiate about it. But there was one part of it that Ben-Gurion was amazed at, because one clause in the proposal was that hundreds of thousands of Palestinian Arabs from the Galilee that would be part of the Jewish state would be expelled and relocated to other parts of Palestine. Well, Ben-Gurion had never been in favor of expulsion because he didn't believe the Gentile world would allow it. When he saw that the Peel Commission had actually entertained and proposed it, when he remembered that in 1948, and that's what allowed him to give the orders that he gave to the military to get rid of as many Arabs as possible from the larger area that Israel took over. So the real danger of Trump's plan is not that the Americans will implement it, but that it encourages and has encouraged the extremes in Israel, who had not really been talking about expelling masses of Palestinians. Now they really are talking about it. And the current operation, designed to drive millions of people into a tiny little area in the southern Gaza Strip, would be a stage in getting rid of them altogether. And so it's not the Trump plan per se, but the effects of the Trump plan inside of Israel, which are the problem.
Well, Trump just had his visit to the Middle East there. You have any? He didn't even see Bibi, didn't see Netanyahu when he was there. There's all this commentary that going to see his buddies, the Saudis, you know, before they dismember another American, I guess. But, it's pretty outrageous.
At least over the last 3 years, it hasn't been easy to find things that have been fun to read. But lately, after Trump's visit to the Middle East, I'll tell you some things that are fun to read, which is the right wing in Israel and in the United States trying to deal with Trump's actions of cozying up to the Saudis and the UAE and taking this airliner and then snubbing Netanyahu, constantly trying to find a way to explain it away, to excuse him, to find some rationale that fits with their the triumphalist rhetoric that they have been using, how Trump is the answer to Israel's prayers, he's saving the country. It's just been very amusing to see how desperately they're trying to find a way to protect their narrative from Trump's unpredictability.
Well, it's kind of the definition of MAGAism in a way. If Trump won the election because of the economy, then everyone who voted for him should be up in arms about how bad the economy is. But they're all making excuses, it seems like.
Well, I think, yes, there's a similarity there, but it's come home to roost very fast among the right-wing commentators in Israel. And I've been enjoying reading them. I think the New York Times has not had as much success finding MAGA voters who say, yes, I'm being hurt by the economic decisions of the tariffs and so on, right. but I'm still glad I voted for Trump. that's the same kind of schadenfreude that I think that I'm experiencing when I read these comments.
And you said that in your book, you've commented that in Paradigm Lost, although probably won't be talking about what the one state reality is versus the two state solution in the few minutes we have left, but you say you foreshadowed, based on the kind of negotiations and discussions that were happening at the time, this situation in Gaza, that it was inevitable that there would be some kind of blowback from Hamas or some other group because of the situation.
Well, people are invited to read my stuff over the last 50 years. I haven't always been right, but I have been right about too many things that I've seen coming. And one of the things that you said, that I say in the book, is that there will be tens of thousands of casualties in the war that will break out over Gaza. So this is not something that was that much of a surprise. What I'm trying to convey is that if you actually think about a situation, if you actually gather information, you can not only understand what's going on, but you can anticipate. Sometimes it's horrible to anticipate it, but you can actually anticipate what's coming down the pike.
Well, in line with some of the discussion we had earlier, even when you point that out to your publisher, they're leery about using that kind of a foreshadowing as a promotion for the book.
I have to say, the University of when the war broke out, I went to the University of Pennsylvania Press and I said, look on page whatever it is, see how I predicted this. Right. Why don't you issue a press release to draw attention? Well, guess what? The University of Pennsylvania did not want to draw attention to the fact that it had published a book that had predicted the war. That's not given, because the administration is focused entirely or almost entirely on how to protect the university from the possible consequences of an angry Congress. So that's an example, going back to our earlier discussion of how the world limits the kind of writing analysis that I do.
Well, I'd like to wrap this up so much. Thank you so much. Ian Lustig, Emeritus Professor of Political Science, University of Pennsylvania. Make sure to look him up for his other writings. Any final comments for people?
There's no substitute for action and learning to make yourself feel able to cope with what's going on. I have traded a long time ago the idea of being bored. I'd rather be engaged and interested. I couldn't stand the idea of mouthing things I knew weren't true, like the two-state solution will come if X and Y, even though it's hard to figure out what to do without that in mind. We didn't get to that topic, but that's one of the tougher things to come to terms with now, is that thinking about the future means thinking about equality and security for all the people who live in the country. It's not about thinking about how you can get two states which are no longer available for negotiations.
Well, maybe we can bring you back to talk about that in the future, and maybe you can tell me something about counterfactual forecasting, which I have no idea about.
Ian Lustig with another hat on.
All right, Ian Lustig again. Thanks so much. This has been Global Stuff, and my name's Jimmy Derschlag.
This has been a KMUD podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast, and also on our website, kmud.org.